The Italian Wine Podcast is the community-driven platform for Italian wine geeks around the world. Support the show by donating at italianwinepodcast.com. Donate 5 or more euros and we'll send you a copy of our latest book, My Italian Grape Geek Journal, absolutely free. To get your free copy of My Italian Grape Geek Journal, click support us at italianwinepodcast.com or wherever you get your pods. Grazie mille. Official media partner, the Italian Wine Podcast, is delighted to present a series of interviews and highlights from the 2023 Wine to Wine Business Forum, featuring Italian wine producers and bringing together some of the most influential voices in the sector to discuss the hottest topics facing the industry today. Don't forget to tune in every Thursday at 3 p.m. or visit theitalianwinepodcast.com for more information.
So good morning again. And we have a very, intriguing topic this morning. It's a hot topic, and we are covering this hot topic with an institution in terms of understanding the market trends, analyzing the alcoholic business with Danny Breger. Danny would not need any presentations, but for those of you who don't know him, he's a guy who spent 20 years with Nielsen covering the alcoholic beverage business. And he now works as a consultant in this field. So, you know, he's a very knowledgeable person and very authoritative in our field. Today, Danny will present the state of the wine industry in the U.S., threats, opportunities, new trends in the face of, as you know, a very challenging year, and also a very challenging future, I would add, for our business. So the wine industry as a whole experienced difficulties this year. Many of you know about the stocking, an abrupt destocking that has taken place this year. Wine consumption on the decline, this is a fact, and quite an apparent demographic shift in the way wine is consumed. So, Danny, is the wine market in the U.S. at risk?
I'm going to start off with that one.
That's all yours.
A difficult question, but I'm very happy to be here and try to answer some of those questions. Just by way of background, I'm actually Canadian. I moved to the United States when I married my wife from Southern California about 30 years ago. So I've been in the U.S. market for the last 30 years, trying to understand trends, shifts in the market across alcoholic beverages, not just wine. And so I want to talk about some of the challenges as well as the opportunities. I'm also in part representing Wine Market Council. Wine Market Council is a nonprofit trade association whose mission is to provide its members with market research about consumer buying habits and attitudes and motivations. I was actually last here I've traveled here a few times, but business-wise, I was at Wine to Wine in 2015. So quite a long time ago, and obviously lots has happened even just over the last 4 years. Let me go back. Missing one slide. Lots has happened over the market over the last 4 years. We've obviously had a pandemic. We're in the midst of all sorts of geopolitical unrest around the world, all sorts of political instability in the United States, and lots of economic strains. And the economic strains are impacting the market. Even though in the United States, the unemployment levels are relatively low, inflation is still relatively high. There's record high consumer debt levels, so people have to pay that off at some point. Interest rates are very high, so that puts strains on consumers as well as on businesses. So there's lots to contend with. And even though we might say in this room that wine is an absolute necessity, for average consumers, it's still a luxury. They have to pay for their food, they have to pay for their gas, they have to pay for housing, and so on. So in the U.S., and there's just a couple numbers up here, it's still the world's largest market. It's around 400 million cases, 386 million in 2022. It has the largest population of regular wine drinkers. There are 80 million wine drinkers in the United States. But it's also within a very competitive market. So the numbers there, and this is some estimates, there's roughly 400,000 wines in the marketplace at any one time in the United States. So that's who we are all competing with, 400,000 wines. There's over 100,000 wines seeking approval from the government for labels every year. So it's an extremely competitive market. It's around, in terms of value, probably close to, I've seen different estimates, 70, 75 billion, you know, so it's an extremely large market. And then if we take that down a little bit further, that 386 million cases, it's about 100 million cases of imports, 84 million table wine, about 23 million of sparkling wine. So it's about over 100,000 cases of imported wine. And within the 80 million, of course, not everybody consumes wine all the time. So within the 80 million, there's about 44 million what we call core wine consumers. Those are people that drink wine once a week or more often. And another 36 million of occasional wine drinkers, people that drink wine but less often than once a week. So still a very big market, but a very complex market. So what I want to talk a little bit about is, I call it fishing where the fish are, but you know what's happening now, as well as where the fish swimming to. So what do I see if I look out into the future in terms of opportunities for the wine category, opportunities for Italy within the wine category, as well as what younger drinkers are drinking, because obviously younger drinkers are the future of the wine category. And I'm going to do it from a numbers perspective. So you'll see a lot of numbers here. Hopefully they'll make the presentation available to you if you're interested in the actual numbers, or if you want, I can send it to you. But I'm going to be using numbers from a number of different data sources because it's difficult to find one data source that kind of represents everything that's going on in the wine category because it's so complex. So I'm going to be looking in some cases at shipments. There's another data source that's depletions, which is what goes from the wholesaler to the retailer on and off premise. I use some Nielsen data because I can look at certain brands and look at certain channels, specifically the off-premise. And then Wine Market Council has some great consumer research, and they're doing a whole bunch of new research just this year. So we just started to release some of that. There'll be more to come, focusing on what wine consumers are doing. And then a little bit from friends at Somm AI, who have tremendous data on wine on-premise and on-premise lists. So first of all, just, you know, we talked about just the unprecedented 4 years, and there's been all kinds of shifts that have gone on. It's made like difficult supply chain disruptions, and we've got wholesalers stocking, destocking, and all the economic strains that I mentioned before. But probably more importantly, or as importantly, I like to think about what's the consumer doing? And I see that in their behavior, not just for wine, but across all beverages. Especially younger drinkers, very interested. Flavor means everything to them. Go to Starbucks, all sorts of different flavors of coffee. But you talk about alcoholic beverages, and there's an increasing interest in flavors, and it comes in different forms and different varieties across beer, wines, and spirits. Extremely interested in wellness, health and wellness, and how, you know, how wine or other things they eat and drink fit in within a healthier lifestyle. Very interested in understanding exactly what they're eating and drinking. So I think Europe's ahead of the United States in terms of wine labeling requirements, but I think that's going to be really important to help consumers understand what they're eating and drinking because they're looking for that information. Convenience seeking, which is both how they shop and the kinds of products they buy and they drink. Very experiential interest, and I loved connecting sort of wine, what I heard last night at the speaker dinner, about connecting wine and glass to the land and offering an experience of understanding the land where wine's from. A lot of interest in just understanding a company's purpose and values and how you communicate that to consumers. And then finally, just at least with the United States, the younger consumer in particular is very ethnically diverse. A large proportion of Hispanics, a large proportion of African Americans, an increasing number of Asians. And so it's really important to understand their culture, understanding their roots, understanding kind of what interests they have that's through their generations and their historical roots. So let's start with the consumer. I just broke it down a little bit more here. The 44 million and the 36 million, that's the 80 million consumers that I was talking about. 44 million core wine consumers, they drink wine a lot, probably account for 80 to 90% of the volume, and then 36 million sort of marginal. They drink wine once in a while, but not as often as once a week or more often. What I think is interesting, there are that red area, those are people that drink beer or spirits or other kinds of alcohol, but they don't drink wine. So to me, they represent an opportunity for how can we bring them into the wine category, probably into the marginal group first and then later on into the core. The other interesting group that continues to grow a little bit is the abstainer. That's almost $70 million consumers, 28%, that's the black area. Those are people that don't drink at all. They don't drink beer or wine or spirits. But it's interesting because that's generally at the older end, but there's an increasing the number of younger consumers who are choosing not to drink wine or beer or spirits. They're just abstaining. But perhaps things like non-alcoholic products can appeal to them. If we break down the 80 million into different groups, so then I organized it by age group and the Hispanic consumer, which is about 17% of American 21 plus are Hispanics, and another 12% are blacks. And I'm showing here just the percentages, that 18% and 15% for overall 21 plus, how that breaks down by different age groups across the top. So for the core group, there are much lower percentages at the younger end, as well as within Hispanics and African Americans. Even when we get into the sort of 40 age group or 50s, they're still relatively low, and that gives me some worry in terms of will they become the what we look at for 70 plus, which is 23% are core consumers. By the time you're 40 or 50, a lot of your preferences are already set. You're loyal to certain things, so it may even be hard to change them over time. The non-adopter, that's the 29% there, but you can see that's very high amongst younger consumers. So these are people that are young, but they're not choosing wine so far. How can we attract them into the wine category? And then, like I mentioned, the abstainers, it's high at the senior end. You see 37 plus for 37% at 70 plus. But it's also pretty high, and it's growing higher at the 21 to 29 age group. Again, people just not wanting to buy or to drink alcohol. In terms of just overall beverage alcohol trends, there's some things that are still the case. I've heard it for years and years. People are not drinking more overall, but they're drinking better, which means they're buying more expensive things. They're trading up or premiumization. But they're not drinking more overall, which means that we're still battling for share. How can we, you know, share of wine within the beverage alcohol overall, beer, wine, and spirits? There are fewer and fewer people that are drinking only wine or only beer or only spirits. They're consuming different things on different occasions. So it's extremely competitive within beverage alcohol. And I would say within sort of the longer term trends are spirits, and I'll show you a couple numbers, but spirits are winning. Wine had been doing quite well until the last sort of 3-4 years where it started to slow down. And in the most recent year, as Ettore mentioned, we've actually seen some declines, and then beer has been declining long term. That's within beverage alcohol. If we go beyond it, there's non-alcoholic beverages, especially younger consumers. And then there's the cannabis market in the United States, where it's legal now to buy cannabis in 25 states. That's over half of the population, so it's not federally legal yet, but it's legal in 25 states. And the Wine Market Council just did some research, and their research says that over 40% of wine drinkers are purchasing cannabis in different forms. It could be to smoke, it could be to drink, it could be to edibles with cannabis or marijuana. But of those 42%, almost 60% sometimes choose cannabis instead of wine for different occasions. So it's tough to get a lot of research on the impact, but I think it's not favorable to have an alternative to wine. So the trends that I mentioned, these are shipment numbers. So I indexed 2016 as 100 and then just looked at the trends since then. So the green line is spirits. The red line is wine. The yellow line is beer. And then the gray line is the total of all those together. So you can see the spirits line continues to grow. Wine had been doing well, and it had been doing well for years and years, but over the last 2, 3, 4 years, it started to slow down. And in the most current year, it's down from where it was last year, but still up versus where it was in prior years. And then if you look at the right-hand side, some of the numbers, the top set are depletions, so sales from the distributor to the retailer. The bottom numbers are retail sales, so from the retailer to the consumer. And you can see the wine volume numbers, they've been in decline, sort of mid-single digits. The total category is still having some difficulties. And there are headwinds for us. So what stands in our way? What are some of the challenges? Well, first of all, I probably don't have to tell you this, but the United States, the word United States is a misnomer for the wine category. It's anything but the United States. The market's very complex. There are state-by-state-by-state regulations, and so it's just complex. It's not united in the way it operates. I mentioned the economy is still difficult. There's certainly a growing amount of interest in social moderation, led by younger generations, but that's something we have to recognize. And there's just a lot more choice. So I call it diversity of choice, but the choice, there's more choice for mainstream products, whether it be beer or wine or spirits. There's this ready-to-drink cocktails, and I'll show you what that kind of looks like. There's non-alcoholic beverages, there's cannabis, and then we've got a lot of pressure in terms of headwinds from that younger generation. So what I used to think of choice being somewhat simple, you know, something like this, like a glass of wine, a beer, or a cocktail. Now it looks like we still got the choices on the left-hand side, but we've got all these other choices that are available for consumers. Could be cannabis that I mentioned. It could be non-alcoholic beverages. There's a growing, still small, but growing amount of non-alcoholic adult beverages. And then there's this ready-to-drink sector that is just kind of crazy, in my opinion. And I'll show you just some examples. But the Wine Market Council, again, did some research recently on consumers, and they asked consumers who are drinking less wine what else they're drinking. If they're drinking less wine, are they drinking other things? So they asked them about their preferences. And these are some of the things that they said that if they don't choose wine, what else are they preferring? So you see things like spirits, so vodka, whiskey, tequila, things like that. But you also see other things like those cocktails, hard seltzers. There is wine-based drinks, so things like sangria or spritzers, wine-based, 32%. But it goes on and on and on in terms of all these other choices that consumers have. And so when I go into a store these days, I see something like this. I see a lot of bottles of wine, but I see sections of the store that look like this. And these are all these ready-to-drink products. Some of them are malt-based or beer. Some of them are wine-based. And a growing amount are spirits-based. But in total, if you add up all those things together, all that stuff on the shelf, it's $11 billion, and it was $5 billion 6 years ago. And people aren't spending a lot more in total, so if they're spending $5 or $6 billion more on this, they're spending $5 or $6 billion less on something else. That right-hand side, those are all some of the examples of spirit-based ready-to-drink cocktails that, in particular, younger consumers are choosing. Brands like High Noon is an example from Gallo, is the brand leader in that ready-to-drink sector. It's about $2 billion now, but it's growing at 40% a year over the last few years. So this is what the growth trend looks like. The blue columns are volume, and the red line is dollars. But it'll be about, it's probably about 40 million 9-liter cases today, and you can just see the growth rate and what that curve looks like. It's the second biggest spirits category after vodka. So it's vodka now, ready-to-drink cocktails, and then you get American whiskey and tequila after that on volume. And it's the fastest-growing segment by far. So it offers, you know, it's convenience. It's usually in a can. All the mixing is done, so it's very convenient. You don't have to do any of the mixing. It's the right size, obviously. It's generally lower ABVs, often sort of 5%, 4%, 6%, something like that. A lot of flavors, a lot of fun, a lot of variety. So that's one competitive sector that we have. In terms of the U.S. wine category, so just a couple just observations. First of all, whites are performing better than reds, generally. Table wines $15 and above are performing better than under $15, but 70% of the table wine category volume is under $11. So as that sector is really big but declining, and that's why it makes it even more difficult for the wine category to grow when 70% of the category is declining, almost 10%. There's several better for you segments that I'll show you. There's some alternative packaging that's relatively small, but it's doing better than glass. Not doing great, but better than glass. And wine cocktails, especially in smaller sizes, again, relatively small, but it's growing well. Not as much as the spirit side, but it's doing okay. And then Italy, we remain the leading import country by far. Our share is relatively flat over the last few years, so it hasn't gone up that much for table or still wine. But it's certainly growing within sparkling wine, and that's been Prosecco-led. When we asked wine consumers at Wine Market Council, why are you consuming less wine these days? These are some of the things that they told us. And I highlighted some things are, I would call them lifestyle-oriented. There's things around diet. There's things around just drinking less alcohol in general. I don't enjoy wine as much as I did before. So those are all the yellow things. And a lot of them are, again, lifestyle oriented. There's some economic things, which are in blue. A couple things, I'm spending less money. I have to pay gas. I have to pay food. I'm just cutting back. And then there's some are the competition, the ones that are in green. I'm starting to prefer other drinks. So all of those things sort of come into play. We also asked wine drinkers about their occasion choices, when they chose wine versus when they didn't choose wine. And generally, and the yellow numbers are I almost always choose wine. The green numbers, I choose something else, or I rarely choose wine. It sort of struck me that the more formal occasion or holidays or more sort of fine dining, wine tends to be the preferred choice. But for more casual occasions, when you're out sort of at a casual restaurant with friends, that's not the case. So in those cases, they're choosing something else. So maybe sometimes, you know, wine needs to be a little less serious, a little bit more fun, a little bit more casual to be shared informally, because that's where we tend to lose out to other beverages. I mentioned the wine alternative packaging. This is what it looks like. The green bars, the bars represent the share. So 750 mil in a bottle is 56% of the category. The yellow dots represent the trend. Is it up or is it down? And you can see the red line going across the page, that's zero. So if I'm above the zero, the dotted line, I'm growing. If I'm under it, I'm declining. So I would say generally that wine is sort of the traditional 750 mil or 1.5s or even larger are not doing very well. It's declining. You get into smaller packaging and they actually aren't doing great in that the yellow dots aren't really high, but at least it's better than being down low. And then you get into alternative packaging, boxes, Tetra Paks, PET, cans. Again, relatively small except for 3-liter boxes are pretty big, but they generally are doing better than large size sort of glass formats. So for Italy, how are we performing and where are the opportunities? First of all, and this represents sort of the commercial side of the mainstream volume side of the business. The top 100 brands, 12 of them are Italian brands in the US market. A brand like Stella Rosa and La Marca, they're two of the top 10 brands in the whole U.S. wine market. If you go through all of the yellow boxes, there's 10 of them, or sorry, 12 that are in the top 100. Italy has roughly 11% of the U.S. wine market. We've got 12 out of the 100 brands, sort of makes sense, of the top 100. And then if you go down further of the top 150 brands, you add in all the brands at the bottom. Whoops, sorry, I'm not showing the slide. I guess I should. So this is the top 100. So I obviously highlighted the brands that are from Italy in those top 100, Stella Rosa and like I said, La Marca, two of the top 10. But you can see we have other ones, including the company you're with, Torre, in Santa Margarita, between 30 and 40. So again, well represented. But let's go a little deeper. So let's go into sparkling wine first. The one thing about sparkling wine that I think is really interesting is that unlike table wine, sparkling wine is preferred by younger consumers. And that's one of the reasons why sparkling wine and Prosecco in particular is doing better than table wine. If wine purchases by age lined up with the share of the population by age, all of those columns would be at 100. So you'd see everything at the 100 line. But you can see that's not the case for table wine. For younger consumers, it's well under. For older consumers, well over. But if we look at sparkling wine or Prosecco, the lines are pretty close to 100. So younger consumers are buying wine in proportion to their share of the population, or buying sparkling wine. So that's one thing sort of in favor of sparkling wine and Prosecco in particular. If we look at Italy's share of sparkling wine by price tier, so this is the different countries, United States, Italy, Spain, and France. The green is Italy. So we have a very high share of sparkling wine between 8 and 13 and between 13 to 18. We've got almost 50% of 8 to 13, almost two-thirds of 13 to 18, and then it really drops as we go higher. I guess my question would be, in terms of opportunities, could we push up into the 18 to 35 range? Because we're only really up against the U.S. sparkling wine in 18 to 35, and the U.S. sparkling wine isn't doing all that well. So maybe we could push up and do better. If we look at how Italy's share of sparkling wine ranges across the 13 states that do the most amount of sparkling wine business, so California does the most, then Florida, then New York, et cetera, and you can see Italy's share right across. It's about 38% for the country, but it ranges. So there's certainly opportunities, I would say. And California is tough because it's the home market for a lot of American wineries. But in Florida, that's where our share gap is the largest. And Florida is the second biggest state in terms of sparkling wine. So maybe there's an opportunity there. And I think you've got a panel coming up about Florida. So maybe we can all learn about Florida a little bit more. And then Prosecco. Prosecco, with the approval to produce and export Prosecco DOC Rosé in 2020, the Prosecco growth rates, and we're looking at growth rates here, you can see they're obviously exceptionally high, but they continue to be high. But that's on top of just the regular white Prosecco doing well as well. So the Prosecco Rosés have really been, in my opinion, largely incremental to Prosecco, and so there's still opportunities. And when I say there's still opportunities, I was looking at how big is rosé as a percentage of the Prosecco market, or sorry, as a percentage of sparkling wine overall. So rosé is about 16% of the sparkling wine market, but in France, it's over 20% of the market. In the U.S., it's almost 20%, but for Prosecco, it's still only 10%. So we're young, but we still got opportunities to grow Prosecco rosé as a percentage and to continue to the growth rates in the market. And then the last thing I'll say about sparkling wine, it's an attractive market, but just also be aware of the structure of the market. The leading brand, which is La Marca, one single brand is over 50% of Prosecco in the United States. Then the next five brands, now we're up to 3/4 of the market. Then the next, or the top 10, we're at 80%. So for everybody else that's not a top 10, we're sort of fighting over the other 20% that's left over in a growing market. Okay, let's just talk about still wine for a couple minutes. Still wine, table wine. I guess the first thing that I would say, and again, I'm kind of a numbers person, is just be aware of the size of the opportunity. So there are ways to figure out how big any segment is. Tell me a price tier, tell me a country or whatever, and we can use some numbers to calculate how much opportunity is there really. So this is the number of 9-liter cases available for import wines overall, not just Italy, but import wines overall in different price tiers. So if I'm looking in the $15 to $25 category, there's 10 million cases of import wine sold in the United States. You get into 25 plus, and that drops to 1 million cases. So just be cognizant of the size of the opportunity as you're looking at your projections for how much wine you could sell in the United States. Secondly, if we look at sort of where Italy, how we do by price tier, and this is our share of import wine by different price tiers, we do really well between 8 to 11, between 11 to 15. You can see we've got 45% of the market. It really drops in 15 to 25, which is still a relatively large portion of the U.S. market. So it feels like, again, that 15 to 25 category where there's a lot of competition, but that's a market where we would like to improve our share to be higher than the 29.3% that it is now. I took a look at Pinot Grigio just because it's the largest single white varietal in the U.S. market. This is Italy's share of Pinot Grigio overall, where our main competitor is the U.S. And our share really ranges here. In a couple price tiers, you've got over 70% of the market. But in something like 11 to 15, which is the one where maybe we could aspire to move up to, we only have 39% of the market. So again, could be an opportunity there. And then I also looked at our share across different states, and this is for still wine, not sparkling wine. New York is the biggest market, and then California is the next biggest for imported table wine. So New York, California, Florida, et cetera. Our share is relatively stable, but again, sort of Florida sticks out to me as a really large market where our share is relatively low compared to other ones. And the other one, and I don't know how much you know about different states, but Colorado is another one of the top 13 states for imported wine, where our share is relatively low. And we can go deeper into it. There's certain regions, different countries that do better in some of those states than we do. I'm going to skip one slide. I know Jeremy's here from Somm AI, who provided, his company provided a little bit of data where we can look at Italy's share of wine placements in the on-premise. And we get things that we would expect, like in New York, we have 20% of the wine placements in the on-premise, similarly with some other states in the Northeast, whereas in places like California or Florida, it's down like 13. But what I thought was interesting, like even in Florida, in West Palm Beach, which is about 100 kilometers north of Miami, pretty upscale, we've got 24% of placements. And then you go into some other cities, very large population cities, and by the way, that's Naples, Florida, not Naples, Italy, where our share, you know, can go down to 9%, 10%. So there's opportunities to focus in on some other areas within the state to improve our position there. Okay, I'm just going to spend 5 minutes talking about sort of younger drinkers and social moderation. And these are just some numbers about sort of some of their attitudes and things that they say in different kinds of surveys that are done all the time. But if you kind of look at these numbers, 44% are interested in trying what they call damp drinking, which is less drinking, basically. And that's led by younger generations. Over 50% say that drinking, even in moderation, is bad for your health. And that number was 34% back 5 years ago. So you can see how much it's changed just over a relatively short amount of time. According to a Nielsen study, 45% of adults 21 to 28, so the Gen Z generation, they claim to not buying any alcohol. So their younger consumers in particular are more and more embracing a lifestyle of social moderation. Either they're drinking less, or in some cases they're not drinking all, or in some cases they're substituting it with something else. And there's other research that sort of says that, or their consumers are saying that how they feel about certain things, and I think it's their perceptions that maybe can be corrected, and it's our responsibility to try to correct some of these. Over 50% say they feel negatively about sulfites in wine. 47% associate with wine being high in sugar. And then about a third associate wine with being high in calories. So that's the negative side. Then on the positive side, for people that are drinking more wine, when we ask them or listen to them about what they say about wine, you know, a good percentage say that it's part of a healthy lifestyle. It's a more moderate drink than other alcoholic beverages. It has positive health benefits. So there's both consumers that feel negatively about things, and if we can change their perception about those things, because there's also a good portion that still feel positively about wine. And over time, we're seeing more and more products being introduced in the marketplace that specifically are going after those characteristics that consumers, younger consumers in particular are looking for. And these are sales numbers for the last 5 years. These are Nielsen measurements, but you just look at the trends of some of those, and then I indicated what the share is for those different things. But the trend is continues to move upward. So it's still, I'd say, relatively small segments, but there are segments that are providing growth for producers when they're introducing products and introducing labels that talk about low sugar, no sugar, organic, low calorie, and some of the things that in particular younger consumers are looking for. And then the last thing on that is that there's more and more products that are non-alcoholic adult beverages. They're growing by double digits. They're still very small. So even for beer, which is more penetrated, non-alcoholic beer is only 1% of the beer category. For wine, it's like 0.3%. But they're growing. They need to taste good and or acceptable to the consumer. So you can't just introduce something consumers don't like. But there's a market for it if it's produced that way. And there's just more out there about better for you. And I don't know if this is the right term legally responsibly to use. But this is I just saw this the other day. It's a distributor in the Northeast that has now a catalog of better for you alcoholic products, wines and spirits. So in that catalog are low-cal, low-sugar, low-ABV, non-alcoholic products. So there's definitely more attention being placed on it, and it's an area for some growth, although relatively small at this point. And health overall, it's not just diet. It's not just exercise. If, again, Wine Market Council research, they ask consumers about what does healthy mean to you? And I thought it was interesting, spending time with family and friends or maintaining the proper work-life balance was as high as anything else. So you can talk about health from a lot of different aspects. It's not all about just what you eat or what you drink. And in the last research that the Wine Market Council did that's just coming out now, for those consumers that are drinking more wine, several of their top reasons. So when we asked them, what are the top reasons why you're drinking more wine? They included several references to wine and health, but to sort of broader definitions of health, like relaxing was actually the number one response. Why I'm drinking more wine, it makes me feel relaxed. So again, health, you know, can mean a lot of different things to a lot of different people. So I'm just going to end off wanted to put a couple takeaways. Be realistic, because there are ways to quantify the opportunity. So you might have some aspirations to sell X amount of cases, but there's ways to sort of figure out, is that realistic or not? And also think about how your product is different from the 400,000 other products that are available to the American consumer. It's okay to innovate, to try new things. I wanted to show this slide that says, wine drinkers, they love to try new products. They want to try new products. They want to try new products from new regions, other countries. They don't necessarily stick to what they've always had in the past, so they're open to new things. I think the thing that was most disappointing to me was they're open to all that, but they don't think the wine category is innovative as maybe we'd like them to think, because only 25% think of wine as being introducing new or innovative things. So innovation can be better for you. It could be alternative packaging. It could be those wine RTD-type drinks, the spritzes or sangrias that are organic or any other sorts of things where you can introduce something new and different to the marketplace. Obviously, it's complex, so it's important to understand it. When I looked at the states, it's obviously important to understand the big markets like New York and markets in the Northeast, but also think about those less developed Italian wine markets. I didn't know until I looked at it that Colorado is a pretty big wine market that's not very well developed for Italy. And then I said market the treasure of wine and what makes it unique, because when I think about wine and all the things that we intersect with and all the things that make us different and unique, and there's some of these and maybe a lot more, but I think we're kind of at the point where as an industry we collectively need to, I love your term, what was it, cooperation? Something like that?
Co-petition.
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 Collaborating and competing at the same time.
So we need to do that. We compete with one another, but as an industry, we have so many good things to say. Collectively, we could do a hopefully a good job of collectively talking about what we bring to the consumer, including obviously the United States, so that we can continue to grow kind of our business in the American market.
On behalf of the audience, the people gathering here, thanks very much for this enlightening presentation. There is a lot to digest, Danny, to be honest with you, because a lot of information. But, I was struck by one slide, the one showing that spirits are still growing and wine, whereas wine is on the decline. So I see some kind of contradiction, in the stats. So spirits going up, wine going down. So it's not, apparently, it's not an alcohol issue, as in some other slides would appear to be. So how would you read this as an analyst, but also, as a guy who frequents the market and may also be a marketeer somehow?
It's a good question, because I would say the same thing. I mean, spirits, high alcohol, more than wine. But if you go a little bit deeper, think about a couple things. One is the RTD segment is part of what's driving that, and that's not high alcohol. That tends to be low alcohol, actually. Like I said, 4%, 5%, 6%. Spirits, and then if you go deeper, tequila, which really big in the American market, a lot of Hispanics, a lot of celebrities, a lot of money. Margarita's the number one cocktail in a restaurant. So you have to go deeper. And then the third thing might be even price. So if I think about price, wine is not inexpensive. An average, if I talk about like a mainstream wine, the price per serving, say something like La Marca, it'd be sort of $2.50 for a glass. If I'm choosing an average, like Tito's Vodka is the number one brand in the American marketplace, that'd be $1 a glass per serving if I'm mixing it. So we're twice as expensive. So there's a price element that comes in. There's a lot of money and a lot of big players in the spirits markets. Diageo, it's a lot of marketing money, a lot of innovation. Every drink can be a new drink. That's why, cocktails, if I want one drink today and another drink tomorrow, I just ask the bartender to make something different. It's frustrating to me when I go into a restaurant sometimes in the States now. It'll cost me $15 for a glass, often, of wine, or $15 for a mixed cocktail where someone's going to do something that I wouldn't do at home. There's lots of competing influences, and you're right, it's not all health. But on the RTD stuff, part of it's health.
Thank you for your contribution to this debate. And, we look forward to seeing you next year, maybe.
You'll see the numbers go this
way. Maybe with better numbers better prospects as well. Thank you very much, Danny.
Thank you.
Listen to the Italian Wine Podcast wherever you get your podcasts. We're on SoundCloud, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Himalaya FM, and more. Don't forget to subscribe and rate the show. If you enjoy listening, please consider donating through italianwinepodcast.com. Any amount helps cover equipment, production, and publication costs. Until next time, cin cin.